and welcome to the 17th episode of Tales for the East, a podcast series for Deniston, Sighthill and Haghill in Glasgow's East End. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Alistair Satchell and I'll be your host for this series. This episode features a chat with Babs Ni Gréagar. Originally from Stornoway, Babs has lived in Glasgow and elsewhere since the late 80s. Babs has worked at Green City in the East End since the millennium. Green City is a wholesaler of ethically sourced food and drink and is also a workers' co-op. In our conversation, we talk about Babs's younger years in Stornoway, leaving Lewis to study in Glasgow, her time in Canada, her love of language and theatre, how she's seen the East End change over the last 20 years, and we go into the nature of Green City's working practices. On another note, we have a Tales for the East exhibition opening up at Deniston Library on Saturday the 2nd of April, where you will be able to see all the portraits of the participants that Tim Marozzo, with whom I share this project, has been taking, including one of Babs. Now, with great pleasure, I pass you over to Babs Ni Gréagar. Who are you?
Well, that's an existential question, Alistair. My Buddhist friends would answer that in a very different way as well from me. But I consider myself a Stornoweegee. So I have one foot in Stornoway in the islands where I grew up. And I always say I was born in Stornoway, but Glasgow has made me who I am, really. And my travels in between in French-speaking countries as well. So who am I? I'm myself. You know, Babs Ni Gréagar. That's the name I go under. And I sometimes answer to Barbara if it's people that are older than me and know me from my childhood days, really. Barbara.
Because my grandmother was a Barbara as well, but she was Barrable, was what they called Barrable.
I love that. I love Barrables, actually. It sounds like, I always felt it sounded like Hannibal. You know, Hannibal going over the Alps, Barrable. I mean, it's Barbara with attitude.
There was no stopping my gran, I'll tell you that.
Was there not? See, I wish I'd been called Barrable, but no, it was Barbara. So Babs kind of became shorter and easier to see and maybe just, you know, fitted into urban life a little bit more. But yeah, I carry the name of my grannies, actually. It's kind of, I'm equally weighted between my maternal line and my paternal line. So I'm called Barbara after Barbara Hione, who was my mother's mother. She was part of a post office family that ran the post office in Crosspost in North Lochs. My father's mother was Mary. So I'm Barbara Mary McGregor. Because I was the first child, it was very important, I think, for them to recognise the grandmother's there. Yes. And then my sister, who came 2 years after me, she got much more elaborate names, nothing to do with the family at all. And I often felt quite jealous about that. But now I'm very glad, actually, to have had the family name, you know. I have a 20-year-old son now. When he was born, I wanted to call him Ishmael because, you know, Moby Dick is one of my favourite novels.
That's the best joke in The Simpsons as well. The sea captain standing there, on the phone. Someone comes into his office and goes, "Call me back, Ishmael."
I love it. Oh, brilliant. I didn't know that. Oh, wow. Well, so Ishmael, but then my cousin Walter, by marriage, who is a Glasgow taxi driver, said, "You can't call him Ishmael. You can't. He'll just be called Pishy." Because in Glasgow, he'll be Ishy and then he'll be Pishy. So you've got to find another name for him, he said. And we didn't have a name for Shawnee until he was born. And I kind of looked at him and he just looked kind of quite, he was quite tappy, as we say in Gaelic, quite full, you know, robust, shall we say, a robust baby with a full face. And Shawnee seemed really good. And that was my mother's father, actually, who ran that post office, Shawnee Honey. So my son is named after my grandfather, whom I never met, actually, but...
It's fascinating that you mentioned Shawnee Honeych. So you're using the patronymics within the families, the names of the people from the lane. How far back can you go with the patronymics? Do you remember, do you know Kenneth's patronymic at all?
No, not my mother would, but you know, it's my parents didn't really talk too much about the lineage at all. I know in other islands, and it's very common, but they didn't really dwell on that too much, or they certainly never passed it on to us. So my mother was a Mackenzie, obviously Shawnee Honey, so there was all the Mackenzies around that, and the Kennedys in Loch Lochs. So I was introduced to a lot of, as kids, we were taken around a lot of old people's houses by my mother. Just, she would go in and look in on them. I would have lots of cups of tea. There invariably would be a very loud ticking clock. You know, there's that kind of stillness.
Yeah. And would you get taken into the Sunday room?
Well, if it existed, not often actually, because we were family.
Not ministers.
But no ministers. And my Auntie Mary in Moorboast, she ran a working man's restaurant actually in Stormy called the Mormac. It was run by a Morrison and a MacArthur. That's why it became the Mormac. And she just used to make very hearty soups and things like that. So in her house in Moorboast, it was the first house you reach in Moorboast when you cross the moor. Mm-hmm. And she was quite used to finding sort of people staggering who'd maybe try to miss the last bus home to whatever on the waste, wherever on the wayside.
Yeah.
But she would always be hospitable. But she had a Sunday room that we hardly ever got into at all. It was like the holy, I don't know, it was the holy of holies, really. It would be probably for the Ordian. That's where it would be for. So the Ordian would be when... the church would have its communions, because in Protestant churches they didn't have the Eucharist, like in the free church they don't have the Eucharist every week or every month. It only happens really, I think, once or twice a year, and it's a big affair, and visiting ministers are invited, and there's a lot of Bible studies in people's houses around the services, and a lot of hospitality, because the one thing about the free church culture is really, like a lot of, I guess, quite evangelical Christian culture is, it's very hospitable. Yeah. So my Auntie Mary would have all these people in that room then. But it was a posh room. I remember it very well because it had a huge big wolf skin draped across the sofa.
Wow.
Because her children, two of them, had emigrated to Canada in the 70s when there was a kind of call out for people to
populate,
I guess, populate, and especially if you had trades and things like that.
Yeah, so my auntie
her
went,
son, did she?
Yeah, they were there for decades,
My auntie went to Vancouver. She was a nurse and she married and went to Vancouver. And my Auntie Mary's children, they ended up in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
Where he was a joiner and ended up teaching joinery in the prison service there.
Oh, gosh.
And Bibi, her daughter, one of her daughters, she married a doctor. And George went over there to be a doctor. So they ended up in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. And so the thing was, every Christmas we would get these presents from Canada, and it was so exotic. We used to look forward to these boxes arriving all year, and then they would arrive. Now, there would be hand-me-downs of clothes.
Fantastic.
Quite often, but there would be clothes that we would never have in Lewis. They'd be, you know, like moccasins.
Oh, wow.
And suede leather, often with kind of First Nation bead work on them.
Oh,
that was quite common. And they'd also send us a big box of red apples, like your Macintosh Reds, but they were a different variety. They were Canadian apples. And that smell when you opened that box was just amazing. So the wolf skin, going back to that, was one of the gifts, I think, that must have come from Canada. And looked so incongruous, I have to say, in this very posh, well, posh sitting room that nobody sat in, because the usual sitting room was a tiny wee one, basically a fireplace and a couch and a chair, and that was it. It was a long, it was kind of narrow and small.
No telly
in that one, no. And they had the fire, so that was the telly.
Aye.
So what happened was, my uncle and us used to sit in front of the fire with his cronies, the bottich, the old men, and they would smoke pipes or whatever, usually always. and they would just chat, and it, often lots of silences, but companionable silences I would see. And then they would go like, oh, shug.
Hey.
Oh, shug. Hey.
Hey.
Shug, shug. Shug, shug, shug. It's exactly. Jeedah. Oh, well, of all. I just, you know, that's an age gone by, isn't it?
I had exactly the same experience with my uncle in Colonsay. It was fantastic. My uncle Hugh, I remember one log that we brought in to put on the fire, and we watched the wood lice jumping off it as they exploded. It was just grotesque now, but back then I was like, oh my goodness, what's going
to happen? It's like cinema.
Yeah, it was. He'd get lost in the flames.
I was born and brought up in a Leverhulme house. The island belonged to a soap magnate, Lord Leverhulme, head of Lever Brothers, and Port Sunshine in Liverpool, you know. And he bought the island of Lewis in the early 20th century and wanted to industrialise it. He was a philanthropist, and I believe he did want the island to flourish, but the way he looked at it was through industrialisation. You know, he had plans for building a railway in Harris and things like that. He had houses built for his workers, and we grew up in one of those in Anderson Road in Stornoway. What he didn't understand, I think, was the people's tie to the land, though.
Yeah.
Because people didn't want to be disconnected from the land, and they didn't want to work in factories or, you know, in fish processing or whale processing, because the whaling was still kind of a thing at the time as well. And eventually he gave up that idea and gave the island back, I suppose, to the people and left. Not without an interesting dialogue and a struggle on behalf of the locals.
Indeed. So what was it like growing up in Stornoway then? Because you say you're Stornorwegian, which is fantastic, but give us the context of, if you can say, like, what it was like to grow up in Stornoway itself. Were you in the centre of the town? Were you in the outskirts? Where were you?
We were near the centre, actually. We weren't bang in the centre, but we were on the periphery of the town as it is, and it would be probably just a 15 minute walk into town at that time. So the population when I was born in 67 would probably have been about 6,000. I was saying to a friend yesterday, I kind of grew up in a strange Gaelic bubble. At that time, Stornoway was the metropolis of the island, and Stornoway really only wanted to speak English for the most part, you know, although there were plenty of people who spoke Gaelic within it. People weren't proactively championing the language at that time, because it was seen as kind of backward, as a hindrance to getting on in life, really. There was no Gaelic medium education. It was assumed, of course, that I guess if you had Gaelic parents that you might be speaking it in the house, but there was no space really for it in the primary school, unless it was maybe for a mod that you had to learn a song for or something like that. But my parents decided to teach Gaelic to me. They spoke to me, and they spoke to each other in Gaelic. They spoke to me in Gaelic and to my sister when she was born 2 years later. We had elderly neighbours beside us who had retired. They had come back from London, Roddy and Olina. They were our adopted grandparents, really, because our grandparents at that time had died, and they spoke Gaelic all the time. He was from Bragar and she was from Bernara. They spoke to us in Gaelic all the time. And there was a family of Harris, the Herochs, Kenny Heroch and his family, just a few doors up from us, from Gyor Crab, from the Bays area of Harris. Their kids all spoke Gaelic and hung about with us. So on this street in Stornoway, it was like there was this little Gaelic bubble, that we existed in Gaelic, unless we went occasionally. My mother wasn't working at the time, so she was a stay-at-home mum, but occasionally she would send me, you know, to the local play school, the nursery school, if she needed to do something. And I couldn't understand why people were kind of just speaking English. I was like quite foreign to me. I didn't like it, really.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And then when I went to primary school, of course, everything was in English. And the emphasis was really, I guess, learn English well, read it, write it. You know, literacy in English was key. But I do remember the headmistress of Stornoway Primary at the time was a Miss Macaulay, who was from Uig. And she would actually, maybe maybe a once a month or so, she would take me into her office for half an hour and just speak to me completely in Gaelic. And I think it was like she That's was lovely. Just worried that maybe I would be losing it, which of course I was. I was losing it. But then at the same time, we also, my father's family come from the west side of Lewis, from a wee village called Tulsachulish. That was our holiday in the year. Our summer holiday was just spent really until I was 11. We spent every summer in Tulsachulish for the most part. And people there spoke Gaelic all the time.
Lovely.
And you'd be in and out of houses. You know, that's the way it was. There was no, you know, knocking at the door. The door was always open. I feel very blessed, really, when I think back, because these older people had so much time to give us as kids, you know, whether it was showing us how to feed motherless lambs, you know, or, there was a cow in the byre that we were allowed to milk occasionally. Salmon was poached quite frequently, and I don't mean in a culinary fashion either.
I'll do it in the milk tonight.
Didn't quite wind more, darling. So we used to get quite a lot of salmon in a black bin bag. That was because the locals used to have their nets out. But the job of the kids, actually, they asked us as kids to look out for the fishery cruiser.
Yeah.
So that was our job as kids when we were playing around the shores, the Quaddoch and Loch Avala, and also just where we used to catch minnows in the wee river.
We were sticklebacks as well.
Sticklebacks, aye. We used to have jam jars full of them. Well, the wee minnows we did. But we would always have a wee eye out for any sort of, what you might call launch activity or boating activity. And then we'd have to run up to Moore's house on the top of the hill, and then she would send the jungle drums going and everyone would run in and take their nets. You know, it's like something out of an Ealing comedy, but they'd try and get their nets in before they lost them, because, you know, these like nets were valuable. You know, valuable source of, you know, additional income for a lot of the crofters, really. Or, you know, they were usually crofting, weaving probably, and doing a bit of the poaching on the side. But they were, halcyon days, I think. And my friends in Tulsachulish, also Erica and Dodo, the MacLeod family, they also spoke Gaelic. So it was really the freedom as well to just roam. That was very different from my son's childhood in Glasgow. You know, you do have advantages, I suppose, to living in a city, but you don't have that same freedom to really just explore nature and the wild, and probably get into quite dangerous situations.
And go feral, yeah.
Feral, but we were quite feral kids, you know, we just went everywhere like that.
At what point did you come to Glasgow?
I came to Glasgow in 1985. I'd finished my higher education at the only main school. The only six-year secondary in the island at that time was the Nicholson Institute. So I came down to Glasgow. I initially wanted to go to Edinburgh because I have a love of languages. Initially, I had a crazy idea, actually, and I often wonder what would have happened if I'd done that. I thought, let's just think out of the box. I thought, I want to study Arabic and Hebrew, and I want to go to the London School of Oriental and African Studies. And I put that in my UCAS form. And then I thought, oh, don't be daft. You don't know anyone in London. You know, it was like, Glasgow is scary enough, never mind going to London, you know. So I never did that, although I have been to both Arabic and Hebrew-speaking countries since then, of course. Yeah. Edinburgh was my choice, and the only reason Edinburgh was my choice was because I was far more familiar with Edinburgh and Glasgow, because I was brought up in the Free Church, and they used to have these exams for kids every year, and they were called the Welfare of Youth Examinations. And there'd be three strands to these at a junior, intermediate, and a senior level, where as a kid you would write an essay, you'd be given a theme of scripture, like a story, you'd have to write the essay. You would then be given a scripture exam and also a catechism exam based on the Westminster Confession of Faith. So, you know, you're doing that when you're 7 years old. You've got to have some kind of degree of literacy, you know, for the juniors. But I won gold medals in these exams, and then I had to come down to Edinburgh to gate them,
yeah.
and I was presented with them at New College.
Mm-hmm.
So my mum accompanied me, and I would get book tokens as prizes, which I loved anyway. And I would go to James Thynnes
and spend them all.
So that's why I thought, all right, I'll go to Edinburgh Uni. But Edinburgh Uni didn't want you if you didn't have Latin.
That's tiresome.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because the thing was, you had a choice in the Nicholson, really, of, you know, like, I loved French.
Yeah.
I was keen to learn German. These were the languages that were on offer at the time. And there was Gaelic and there was Latin. So if I was to do Latin, I wouldn't have been able to do Gaelic.
Mm.
So there was a choice between a dead language and a living one.
Yeah.
That might have been people, some people might have perceived was on its deathbed. But so many people that were doing, you know, like things like law or had aspirations to be lawyers or accountants, they all did Latin.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, isn't it? Because you think of it as you've got this living language of your heritage that's there, and you take a dead language over that. It just speaks volumes as to how people regarded Gaelic at that time. So I didn't get into Edinburgh because I didn't do Latin, I did Gaelic. So that's how I ended up in Glasgow.
In Glasgow Uni itself, or?
Aye. And this is a thing too. See, I loved football, and I don't really do so much of that much, you know, like football isn't such a big thing in my life now. But it was when I was growing up, you know, because there wasn't so much culture in Stornoway, really.
Was
so
a Lunter there at all?
No, not at all. No. In fact, there was nothing at all initially. And then there was a thing called the Acres Boys Club that Charlie Nicholson started up. And that became a kind of youth club for sport.
Okay.
So the two things that you had out with school were religion or church activities, or sport. So that can be, you know, summed up in my Saturday morning would be, after Saturday morning telly, I'd go to the swimming pool because the Stornoway swimming pool was built in about 1976.
Hmm.
That was the first swimming pool in the island, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great because that meant that people could learn to swim instead of being washed away and swept away to sea.
Oh,
because
yeah.
There were quite a lot of drownings when I was growing up.
Yeah.
But also then we would go to psalmody class on a Saturday after that, where we would learn the metrical psalms in four parts with Mrs. McCritchie, the minister's wife, whose weapon was a tuning fork. And she'd go, bing! She was lovely, you know, bing. She didn't use it as a weapon. That was her thing. And we would spend an hour learning some of the lesser known tunes in the Psalter, like St. Kilda. I still remember St. Kilda. So that was interesting. That was my Saturday morning. But sport, yay. And then the comics. I would get my comics I would move on to musical. You know, I would get Shoot. So
do
you remember that?
Yeah.
I used to get 15 pence, 20 pence it would have been at the time, 15 pence to buy Shoot, and then 5 pence for Parma Violets for 1 pence, Penny Chews, and I think McCowan's Toffee was 2. So I kind of ruined my teeth and improved my football knowledge. Every Saturday as well. So, cut a long story short, somebody once asked me when I was 6, what team do you support, Celtic or Rangers? And I didn't know who Celtic or Rangers were at the time. But I thought Rangers sounded really romantic because I knew of the Lone Ranger.
Oh, yes.
And I thought, well, you know, I mean, Rangers sounds really interesting. It was like, it's like an American, like Lone Ranger. So I said Rangers blindly. And it was obviously the right answer with this person. So they said, oh, yeah, good. And then, of course, you know, I started supporting Rangers. I like blue anyway as a colour. Red, white and blue maybe less so as a combination. But, so one of the reasons I also chose Glasgow was Rangers played there.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember going to my very first match and actually almost my last match, because there was a very big difference between watching a match on Sports Scene with Doogie Donnelly
of course,
or Archie McPherson,
and
his earpiece, And then going and standing on the terraces of Ibrox at the time, oh, because it wasn't seated, with all these guys swearing and peeing and drunk, and also the whole orange thing. I had no idea of that. I was totally unaware of all that kind of culture from Northern Ireland.
Been shocking.
And it was against Aberdeen as well, who are Rangers, one of their, out with Celtic, Aberdeen, I think, are Rangers enemies, top enemies. And so they were bottled, the match was stopped because bottles were, the glass bottle was thrown at the referee and then it hit a player and they stretchered off. And I had gone there in good faith with my very genteel friends from Stornoway. We were all girls as well. And we thought, never again are we going, you know, and that put me off, really kind of put me off football at that degree of intensity for life, really. And I found instead that I found the cinema and the theatre and that kind of world were far more to my taste.
Yeah, so the Tron Theatre in Glasgow at that point with Michel Trombley's plays. I know we talked about this previously, but like the Tron Theatre under Michael Boyd was a thing of absolute wonder. Really, in my parents' house in Dunoon, where I grew up, on the wall, I still have "The Trick Is to Keep Breathing" as a poster from all those years ago.
Amazing.
That was what made me want to make theatre, seeing that. I'll never forget Forbes sitting in the seat in front of me in the audience in character. The light suddenly, you know, at the start of the play, boom, the light suddenly goes on to him, and the first thing he says is, "So, why do you think you've been sent to us?" And he just repeats it about 15 times. And Karen Black, I think it was, Jennifer Black was one of the lead actors in it. I think it might have been her. It was Siobhan Redmond. Siobhan Redmond was saying, "Oh, well, I don't know. I think it's this, and then it's that." And, I was away. That was it. And that's ever since that moment, that's what I've wanted to do was theatre. And
Theatre is magic. I love it. And I studied it.
Did you?
So my area of study at Glasgow Uni and my dissertation, my final year of my French degree, was theatre and cinema in Quebec.
Oh, lovely.
So French Canada, because I'd started reading Trombley's pieces. We'd done Jacques Godbout as well, Salut Garano. Later, after I finished that degree, and a few years after I'd finished my hospitality management degree, I went back to start a PhD with Glasgow on theatre and cinema in Quebec, basically. And I spent a year in Montreal studying it. And that was amazing. I never did finish the PhD, but I learned a hell of a lot about just how vibrant the theatre scene was there. The greatest gift I got when I landed in Montreal in late September, early October 1992, was a festival on called Les 20 Jours du Théâtre à Risque. So it was the 20 days of risk theatre or risk-taking theatre. And it was just amazing. Just so many people putting plays on in crazy places, topics totally off-piste, maybe quite controversial, but also the way that the theatre was done. You know, there's no holes barred, really. It was just opened my eyes to the potential of that medium to really engage debate, you know, provoke debate, engage people. I've loved theatre ever since. I think it's, I guess, you know, coming from a very religious background, it's just become I've moved from the church to the theatre. And as Peter Brook would say, you know, it's a holy space anyway. It's a sacred space, theatre. I can't remember. What's this famous book, actually, Peter Brook?
The Empty Space.
Yeah, The Empty Space. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he recognised, you know, the magic of the tramway. I never saw the Mahabharata, but I've heard about it. I do remember seeing Les Belles Sœurs with Michael Boyd at the Tron in 1990 in the Year of Culture.
Wow.
And I think before then, I think it was really through just my studying of theatre at uni that I got into it, really. It wasn't until I really had been over in Montreal, I'd come back and was really then into it, because a lot of my friends in Montreal that I made, they were all involved in theatre in some way.
Let's come back to the UK now. And you the reason that we met was because you work in the east end of the city in Hag Hill. Can I ask you to say a little bit about where you work and how you ended up working there as well?
I guess we call it Deniston, as opposed to Hag Hill, because it's kind of the badlands of Duke Street when you're going towards the badlands. You know, you've gone past all the shops and then you get past the Cumbernauld Road and past the bakery, and you've got a wee dog leg of a street, and that's Fleming Street, where Green City is. So I work for Green City, a worker cooperative. We are a wholesaler of vegetarian and vegan foodstuffs and drinks, and we deliver across Scotland and north of England and by carrier to Northern Ireland and to islands like Mull and places like that through carrier as well. I joined Green City in 2000. I'd kind of dropped out of the PhD. I'd got a part-time job for a while in John Smith's bookshop, as was on St. Lovely. Vincent Street, although in TSO, so it wasn't the most, it was TSO was really where a lot of the legislation, you know, it was the stationery office, so it was dealing with legislation and acts and laws. But again, that was quite interesting because at the time too, you know, Scotland Act and things like that were coming into play. So I'd finished there because I'd been offered a role touring with a play called in Gaelic with Theatre Highland called In Clonmore.
Oh, goodness me.
Tweed.
Wow. Yeah.
So I was in this play as one of the characters, and it was a great experience, actually. I got to work with legends like Don McLennan. And Sheen wasn't in it. It was Kenny McCrae was the lead in it. And it was fun. And basically the idea was that it was kind of quite a historical piece about the story of Harris Tweed, but it had a kind of personal love story in it as well. And we had funding to really deliver that play across areas where islanders would have gone following the fishing and things like that. Not just where Tweed, we put it on in places like, I'm sure, Kelso and the borders are Hoyk because of the textile connection, but also in places like Kinlochbervie and Malig, certainly Peterhead. I remember Peterhead because of the fishing.
Yep.
And we ended up right down in Camden and Camden Theatre doing it in London. So when I'd finished that, I was without work and I thought, right, I had volunteered in the past for the Big Issue. I kind of bought the Big Issue regularly, and I saw in the back of it an advert had been put in by Green City Whole Foods, a worker co-op, and they were looking for somebody for their warehouse. I had no warehouse experience at all, but it was the fact that they were a worker co-op that kind of swung it for me, because I thought, I really, really think I would like to work in that kind of setup where as a worker you've got autonomy, you've got your own voice. There's not a top-down hierarchy. It's very level, flat structure. So I went for the job and I got it. That was in 2000. And I remember them asking me at the time, in fact, one of the people who interviewed me had green hair. Oh. That was Dom Regan. And I thought to myself, wow, he must be really committed to Green City. He's even dyed his hair the same colour. And they asked me how long I intended to stay there. And I said, well, you know, because I was kind of used to chopping and changing. You know, I didn't really stay at a thing to that long. And I thought, oh, well, 5 years of my life. I'll give you 5 years of my life. And here I am in 2022, 22 years later, and I'm still there, which is quite crazy now.
What do you think is the factor that's made you stay for that long then? What is it about this workers' cooperative that's made you stay?
It's quite unique, I think. I think it's also a combination of certainly the structure, you know, the non-hierarchical structure, the degree of autonomy that you have in your working life, and the way that, you know, you can, I suppose, exercise your own initiative to some degree. So I would say, you know, I suppose I went in there quite a communist, and now I'm probably more an anarchist in some ways, because it kind of, I suppose you're asking people to I mean, it's when I went, there was 25 people, and now there's 55. So we have grown organically over the years. Definitely a pace that suited us, I think. But, you know, one day is never really the same as another. I've always enjoyed the relationships with the people, and that, you know, I would consider Green City really as my adopted family, really.
That's lovely.
And so many people have really stayed there for quite a while, you know, and I would say it's actually been a university of life for me. Mm-hmm. So life skills I've learned at Green City, my academic skills certainly, you know, at Glasgow Uni and in various degrees that I've done, but certainly life skills, and I think just understanding human nature better and being a better cooperator as well, you know, like working in collectives and mm-hmm. parking your ego by the door and mm-hmm. really trying to find, you know, solution-based thinking, trying to work things out and giving everybody respect and a voice in that process, which can take time, of course. Oh, yeah. You know, co-ops don't necessarily move fast. That's the thing. But then usually I think, you know, it's things are considered like that. So I was speaking to Marianne yesterday, Marianne Kennedy, and she was saying, well, you know, your co-op reminds me of kind of the way crofting works. Crofting, you can't survive on your own. You don't take your own risks. You're in there with the rest of your community. You're very dependent on the community that you're part of to help you out. They're dependent on you to help them out when yeah. they need, you know, help with the sheep or the yep. or, you know, whatever, the peats or that kind of stuff. Yep. So in a sense, I feel that sense of collective and cooperation is probably in my DNA, coming yep. from a Gaelic speaking crofting background, I suppose. That's quite interesting.
That's fantastic to hear that applied to, you know, the city. That's a brilliant thing. Yeah.
It's totally transferable. You know, I think these crossover things are, well, you know, one of the things they always say is transferable skills, but really mm-hmm. it's attitudes, transferable attitudes as well, of course. That's what we're talking about here.
Does the East End of the city mean to Green City, but also to yourself? So Denniston and St Helen Haghill, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's the place I work in. It's the place I go to every day. I've lived both in the West End of Glasgow and in the South Side briefly, but I've been going to Denniston on a daily basis since 2000. And I have seen the area change quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, I suppose, Duke Street in 2000, full of pubs and tanning salons and yes. bookies, basically. And there would have been Coya's Cafe, which would have been the one place, I guess, you'd have got a decent coffee, you know. Yeah. But apart from that, it's a kind of like a wee bit like, I often think Duke Street and that part of Duke Street and Partick are not dissimilar. You know, working class communities are a lot of small little shops. They all kind of live off each other kind of thing in quite an integrated, you know, quite intuitively integrated way. Yeah. But what I've seen, obviously, over the years, as you have, I'm sure, too, is, for want of a better word, the gentrification of the area to some extent. And I suppose a lot of that is to do with housing. I suppose it's because housing in the West End that was prohibitive prices for people would yeah. then go to the South Side. So people like maybe my age would have probably got a mortgage on the South Side, say like Govanhill or Shawlands or someplace like that. But millennials now, or people of that age, the South Side is too expensive, so they would be moving to the East End. You know, it's the next area, really. Yeah. So that's what you've seen. You've seen a demographic change, and I see it all the time when I'm cycling, because to work on my commute, because there's, you know, you get to know the people yeah. that are walking in every day. I guess one of the change things was when Tapa with Robert and Ginny opened up their first organic bakehouse. And it was basically an organic bakery and a coffee roaster, because they were both from New Zealand and loved their coffee. And I remember people saying, well, that'll never take off in the East End, you know, that's just ridiculous, you know, and lo and behold.
Yes.
So they started off, and then you saw other places then coming in, and this is, I mean, I'm just naming restaurants and pubs because that's the area, that's the kind of sector I'm in, I work in. So you'd have maybe Tebow, Cafe Tebow coming in, and then laterally, I mean, Redmond's, of course. You've got the Dry Gate moving on from, so Williams Brothers, I mean, Green City, we've stocked Williams Brothers from the very, very early days when there were maybe only four beers that they used to brew. Oh. And they were the old Scottish brews that they used to do. So they used to do Heather Ale through, which was the best seller. Uh-huh. They used to do Kelpie, which was the one with the seaweed. And they used to do Alapa, which was the pine ale. Oh. And a... can't remember actually the other one they used to do. No, Grosie, the one with gooseberries in it.
Oh.
So they were all Scottish recipes, and that's how Heather Ale or Williams Brothers started out. They used to have a place on Woodlands Road when I was a student, maybe it would have been towards the late 90s, actually. It's where the Eye Cafe is now. That's where they had the brewery. They actually had the open brewery. You could actually see them making the stuff. And they would, you'd go along and get a plastic kind of 5 litre thing, and you would just fill it up with beer. And that's the first time, you know, that's where they started. So the Dry Gate, obviously, the Williams Brothers tenants were kind of maybe needing to refresh their brand and hang out with younger, more innovative craft beer people, because the market has gone craft, you know, and Tennent's is just mainstream. So Tennent's provided a lot of the funding for Williams Brothers to set up the Dry Gate area and get, I think it's 3 or 4 young brewers in, and they experiment quite a lot with their different beers and stuff. And we've been lucky at Green City to have visits around all these places. So we have very strong links with certainly our suppliers and our local suppliers in particular. I mean, the ethos of Green City, it's not just a worker co-op, like, so one person, one vote, you know, equal pay, equal say is how we rock. So there's a workplace democracy thing. So if we make profits, basically, it doesn't go to a distant shareholder. It goes straight back into the pockets of the workers, and a part of it is put aside as well to invest in the business and develop it. So that's key. But also we're part of a wider food circle, and certainly, you know, we've become far more aware of that in recent years, you know, when we're looking at food being grown for people rather than just as a commodity, as a product for commodity markets. Yeah. And that food should be for the people, and it shouldn't just be really sold to people by 6 big supermarkets or corporations, if you like. You know, also the links with producers has become a big thing, and short supply chains, localization of your food culture. So we have a farmer who grows oats for us, Clifton Hill Oats. We're wanting to do more of that, actually, work closer with farmers, you know, because I guess the great thing about being a worker co-op is that you can get yourself involved, and not just, you know, when you talk about the co-op world, it's global.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of worker co-ops in Scotland is relatively small at the moment, although there's a real interest in that business model now. I mean, Green City is quite unique, and in that it is equal pay, equal say. No matter what job you do at Green City, you get the same wage as somebody else. So you might be packing or you might be warehousing, but you will be earning the same amount of money as somebody who's in the accounts office or whatever. So that isn't to everybody's taste. Some people think that's unfair, you know, like pay grade, you know, if they've done a certain amount of learning, then they should be entitled to a certain wage. But the ethos of Green City is different, you know, and I think in worker co-ops in general, I think because it would work best, I think, if people actually rotate jobs. So when I joined Green City in 2000, there's a lot more of that happening.
Yeah.
So you'd have somebody maybe doing sales for maybe 3 days a week, and then maybe they would be doing a wee bit in the warehouse, or they would be then, you know, maybe doing a wee bit on computing or IT or whatever.
Sounds
that
great.
Kind of thing.
Lovely, so just moving around all the time, like, but within
yeah,
the same
for me, lovely. For me, I love that because it's like, I mean, at one point I was doing a bit of buying, procurement. I was doing HR as well as part of a team, but heading up that team. And I was also working in the warehouse. So that's three different, I mean, it kind of got a wee bit mental because HR actually is pretty all consuming, especially yeah. as your workforce is growing. And we recognised that belatedly in 2018. I think we hired our first bespoke HR person because before we'd always been handling it as workers in a team. So
it's that kind of through line, doesn't it? Yeah.
But I think it's far better to have somebody on that all the time. But yeah, you know, there's never a dull day really at Green City, I don't think. But I think a lot of it's to do with also the kind of people a worker co-op attracts. Because it's a little bit anarchic and stuff like that, the people it attracts are generally people who have a, you know, they're not just there for the work. They're there to, I guess, have fun. Yeah. And there's a real passion. I think the warehouse is my favourite department, really. And that's because I think it's the arts faculty of Green City. So, you know, music is really important there. Film, or we'll talk about books we've read or that kind of thing. You know, there's a natural intelligence that's allowed to bubble and develop. And also, you know, I think for me, Green City is also a kind of gateway to be involved in other movements. So as part of our profits, for example, every year we donate a percentage of those to a local charity, an environmental charity, a global one, and an animal welfare one. Because these are the kind of, or when I say charity, it could be an NGO as well, right? So one of the NGOs was medical aid for Palestinians. So we because we, you know, Green City was one of the first companies really to be promoting fair trade as well before it became kind of mainstream. Martin Meatyard and Scott, who still works at Green City, they were part of the movement that, you know, really worked hard to make Glasgow a fair trade city.
Yes.
So that fair trade connection then brings you into connection with all different kinds of producers globally.
Yeah.
Many of whom work in co-ops, actually.
Yeah.
And I remember in my first year, I think my first or second year at Green City, we had a cooperative coming over from Bolivia.
Wow.
Brought over by Equal Exchange, and they were nut growers.
Wow.
One of the companies who, a kick that provide Palestinian fair trade olive oil and dates, medjool dates, and also olives and nuts at times are Situn. They support Palestinian farming co-ops, most of whom are in the West Bank. And we've had a couple of those farmers come over and talk about their work. And, you know, that's when you realise that the work that you do, see with food, food has so many connections anyway, you know, it really does. It's that's why I love working in this sector, because you can make so many human connections and can tackle quite a lot of injustices in it and try and work for the good of everybody within that system.
Fantastic. There's so much you've given me there. Just to round off, though, is there any kind of thoughts that you have about life in Glasgow as a Stornoweegian?
Oh, I love it. You know, I love the freedom of it. You know, I'm in a same-sex relationship, which would be probably not very popular amongst my, you know, with certain people in my island, certainly not the church community. So I feel a great freedom in Glasgow, actually. And in Green City as well, you know, it's such a kind of open, friendly place like that. You were saying actually how the East End had changed. And I tell a story. So it was my first month at working at Green City, and I'd bought a 3 kilo bag of lentils to go back home and make some lentil dal. And I remember walking along Duke Street, and there was a wee boy, and I met him on the street, and he says, "What's that?" And I said, "Oh, they're lentils. What are they? What do you do with them?" I said, "Oh, you can make a nice pot of soup with them." He said, "How'd you do that?" I talked to this wee boy. He must have been about 9 or 10 anyway. And I often think now back to that because, you know, one of the initiatives or groups that we support is Nourish, a pressure group for looking at the right to good food as a human right. And they want that to be encased in Scottish law or enshrined in Scottish law, right? So look up Nourish because they've got loads of interesting stuff going on there. But one of Nourish's main aims was that every kid leaving school in Scotland would know how to make a nourishing pot of soup.
Fantastic.
And I do think of that wee boy quite often, and I wonder where he is now, and I hope that he is able to make soup, even if it's just lentil soup. I did give him quite good detailed instructions.
Thank you so much, Babs. Fadjirach gasta vi chapadich rihela. Himi uren an urirshan kora rihela sagalig. Babs and I will be catching up again soon for a conversation about the nature of Gaelic in Glasgow. So, if you're interested to hear more on that, please do check in with the podcast later on next month. Tales for the East is an artist-in-residence project from Glasgow Life, and I'm lucky enough to share the position with my friend, the photographer, Tim Marozzo. If you want to join us for an exhibition of Tim's photos from the podcast, as I mentioned at the start of the episode, please do feel free to take a trip over to Denniston Library from the 2nd of April, where you'll see all of Tim's portraits up on the wall. If you want to reach out to us and say hello on social media, just type in Tales for the East and you should find us. Our website, tales-fae-the-east.com, gives you some more info about the project and provides links to subjects covered in the episodes. The project will be coming to an end in the last week of April, and we still have a few more episodes to come out, which I can't wait to share with you. Thank you for listening, wherever you are. Mórin thai. Mimi Rishiv. See you again soon. Tadibai. Bye.